Yeah, thanks very much, Tony, and the other organisers for putting together this interesting conference. And I'm very pleased to be in my home, back in my hometown, which I come back to still a lot, to give this talk. Although this campus didn't exist when I was an undergrad. So what I'm going to do today is address the issue of the conference and talk about imbalances and, to some extent, defend imbalances. And I'm going to particularly focus in the talk today on looking at things from a capital flow perspective. So current account deficits have a pretty poor reputation around the world at the moment, unfairly so, I think, in my opinion. So while in some instances this reputation is earned, today I want to provide some arguments in their defence and highlighting that there are a number of circumstances in which one should not be too concerned about their presence. So in particular, I want to make the point that deficit does not have to equal imbalance, which is often assumed, and deficits are not always and everywhere a bad thing, notwithstanding the pejorative connotation of the word deficit. And so if you step back a bit and think about it, deficits are generally, all the language associated with current account deficits is pejorative. They deteriorate rather than widen, and they improve rather than narrow. So that already gets them off to a bad start. So at a minimum, I think we could at least remove that pejorative language when we're discussing deficits. So what I'm going to do today is focus a bit more on the cross-border capital flows, which are the mirror of current account positions, and make the point that cross-border capital flows can convey large benefits. Now, much of my argument is presented considerably more eloquently in a recent paper by Max Corden, and I would actually suggest that probably rather than listen to me, you go and read Max's paper, which is published a couple on this topic in the very recent past, and including one through the CEPR in the last few months. And I hope I can do some justice to the position that Max puts today, but I would certainly suggest that you go and read that. So what I'll do is I'll start by presenting a short summary of the global imbalance argument, and then I will present a framework with which one can think about the issue and present a case for the defence of deficits or imbalances. Then, to provide some practical example, in the final part of the speech, I'll describe some recent developments in the Australian current account position, and particularly the associated capital flows. So, whereas Olivier Blanchard, as Steve mentioned, has been contributing helpfully on the issue of capital controls, I'm not so keen on Olivier's recent work on global imbalances, which he's done with Jean-Marie Amalessi-Ferretti. So they provide a concise summary of the global imbalance argument in a recent IMF paper that came out a few months ago, and they describe the difference between good and bad current account deficits. So bad current account deficits are those which result from domestic distortions or excessive fiscal positions. Good ones are those which don't have those causes. So, as most of you in this room are probably aware, that's effectively Pitchford-Lawson redux. So, as you may recall, John Pitchford and Nigel Lawson, who was, at least in those days, famous for being Chancellor of the Exchequer, nowadays he's more famous for being father of Nigella, presented the consenting adult's view of current account positions. So, as long as current account positions are the result of savings and investment decisions by the private sector, which are not affected by distortions, then there is no cause for concern. That was basically the argument that the two of them put separately. Pitchford and Lawson used that framework to argue that the current account positions in their respective countries, Australia and the UK, did not represent an imbalance, given the absence of any apparent distortion. In contrast, Olivier and Jean Maria conclude that even good current accounts are mostly bad too, and hence most current account deficits can be categorised as imbalances, so which I think is a gross overstatement of the case. So Blanchard and Malesi-Ferretti also make the point that it's important to look beyond current accounts to the whole structure of the capital account. And so while disagreeing with their conclusion that current accounts are mostly bad, this is a point I would wholeheartedly endorse for two reasons. So firstly, current accounts are fundamentally endogenous. They reflect the net outcome of a raft of savings and investment decisions that we're discussing this morning, taken by households, businesses and governments across the whole economy. The current account is a symptom, not the cause. If one is concerned about the imbalance, the focus should be on the policy that is causing it, not on the deficit itself. Secondly, the capital account, which is the mirror of the current account, is the net of a large array of gross capital flows. And these flows also reflect the financial decisions taken by both domestic and foreign investors. So, for example, and this is relevant to a question that was asked in the previous session, so in the global imbalances debate, it is often noted that Europe has a current account position that is close to zero. This is particularly noted by the Europeans. This is true, but it masks large divergences between current account positions within the euro area, and they are actually symptomatic of the problems manifesting themselves right at the moment. Secondly, there is nothing intrinsically optimal about zero. It's just a number. So it may well be the case that the appropriate balance for Europe is not zero, but distortions of one form or another have delivered such an outcome. If that were the case, and I'm not necessarily saying that it is the case, but if that were the case, then Europe would be contributing to global imbalances as much as China or the US. Thirdly, behind the European zero balance, there are very large capital flows in both directions. Some of those flows, most obviously investment in US subprime mortgage securities, were clearly bad flows, while other flows were clearly beneficial. So similarly, if you're looking at it from the US point of view, the US current account deficit through the 2000s was a net balance of very large capital inflows and outflows. Much of the inflows were into either US treasuries or to US mortgage securities, while a sizable share of the outflow was foreign direct investment by US corporations. So US, as is often been remarked, particularly more recently by Helene Ray and Pierre-Olivier Grinches, was able to earn relatively more on its stock of foreign assets than it paid on its foreign liabilities, such notwithstanding the fact that it has a stock of net foreign liabilities, its net income position, at least up until recently, was often in surpluses. So some of those flows in and out of the US were clearly bad, at least ex post, such as those which found their way into poor performing securities. However, very few people were able to identify ex ante the distortion that was generating these harmful flows. Ex post, we've now got plenty of people able to identify that distortion. But other flows in and out of the US were clearly good. But the point to make is that focusing on the net balance of these flows, which is the current account position, is not particularly helpful relative to more scrutiny of the various components of the underlying capital flows, and particularly the gross capital flows. So let me provide a bit of context and provide a couple of simple examples which help to illustrate my point to make a defence of current account deficits. So one place to start is with an overlapping generations model of a closed economy. A good place for me to start with that is because Olivier actually was the one who taught me the overlapping generations model of a closed economy. So we can think of that as a country. Within this country, there are households that are at various stages of their life cycle. The younger working households save, the middle-aged households borrow, and the older households run down their stock of accumulated savings. So we have imbalances across that household sector, to use the terminology which is used to describe things across the globe. The young households have current account surpluses. The middle-aged households, like me, are in current account deficit. But these imbalances are not generally cause for concern. In my case, I wouldn't mind if my current account deficit was a little smaller than it currently is. But nevertheless, they're not a cause for concern. It would not be socially desirable if there were no cash flows between households, but that's what we're talking about, by and large, if we're talking about zero current account balances across countries. Alternatively, we can consider the Australian states. At any point in time, there can be large current account positions between the Australian states. There are large financial flows across state borders as well. Are we even aware that this is the case? And should we be concerned? By and large, I suspect we're not even aware that this is the case, or at least we don't think about it, and I don't think we should be that concerned. So it's useful to think about why any such imbalances across the Australian states are not a cause for concern. And here, obviously, we're straying into the optimal currency literature, which is currently front and centre in the context of the problems of the European periphery at the moment. So some of the reasons, just to elaborate, why we are not concerned about the current account imbalances of the Australian states, is that the Australian states have a common currency, they've got a federal fiscal system, they've got sizable interstate labour mobility, of which I and most of my fellow Adelaide diaspora are good examples of, and generally experience similar economic shocks. So they are the main prerequisites identified for an optimal currency area. So the point of the two scenarios I'm described here, one about Australian states and two even about thinking about households within a closed economy, is that current account positions and even large current account positions can exist that are benign and could not be classified as imbalances. The capital flows that are the counterpart to these current account positions are good because they are associated with appropriate intergenerational transfers in the first case and appropriate cross-border flows in an integrated economy in the second. So Max Corden, when he's looking at this issue, distills the concern that many have about global imbalances down to a concern about what Max calls the return journey. Lenders of capital expect to receive the money they have lent back, and they expect to receive it back with interest, in the literal sense here, not the colloquial sense. So one reason that might increase concern as we move from transfers between households to crossing state borders to crossing national borders is that the information asymmetry about the return journey increases. Amongst other things, the geographic separation reduces the ability of the lender to monitor the use of funds by the end borrower. So one could question why this still remains true today, with increased transparency and lower costs of information and a vast funds management industry out there, why is it the case that we still have these very large informational asymmetries? For example, in a recent episode, in 2008, the funds that made their way to the US housing market over the 2000s had a long and non-transparent chain between the provider of the funds and the ultimate borrower. So there are many major problems of information asymmetry and major failures of due diligence right along the chain, although why that had to be the case is not entirely clear. Another reason that borders matter is that the capacity to borrow in one's own currency is important in this discussion. So the claims across Australian state borders are denominated in Australian dollars, which are easily settled without doubt in the integrated Australian financial system. Indeed, the system is so integrated that there is no easily obtainable measure of cross-border claims for the states. A further aspect that appears to be a common cause for concern about current account deficits is the economic adjustment that might occur were they to narrow precipitously. So much of that concern, in my opinion, appears to stem from a fixed exchange rate view of the world. So in a fixed exchange rate world, sudden stops can and obviously did occur that are very disruptive. Capital inflows dry up rapidly and capital outflows increase, necessitating a sharp contraction of domestic demand so that the trade balance moves into surplus. Inevitably, this is associated with a domestic recession. So such a scenario does not directly translate into a world of floating exchange rates. In that environment, the main mechanism of adjustment is the exchange rate. If global investors reduce their appetite for investment in a particular country, the exchange rate depreciates until the point where investors would be happy once again with their allocation to that country in their overall portfolio. Now, obviously, the exchange rate might overshoot in this scenario, and in particular examples recently, actually more back in the Asian crisis around Korea and Indonesia, most obviously, the exchange rate overshot quite dramatically. But nevertheless, the depreciation is stimulatory to the economy, whereas in the fixed exchange rate world, the adjustment is contractionary. Now, whether the exchange rate is stimulatory is also affected by a point I made earlier about whether the claims are denominated in foreign currency or in local currency. So the conclusion I wish to draw then is that there can be perfectly good reasons why current account balances are not zero, and indeed can even be quite sizable, without them constituting imbalances or being a cause for concern. The accompanying capital flows are often beneficial. That is not to say that they should not be scrutinised, but rather that the current account should not be scrutinised, but rather that the scrutiny should really be on the nature of those capital flows to examine whether they are being driven by inappropriate policies or distortions or inappropriate investment behaviour. So with that discussion in mind, what I want to do now, is look at do a short analysis of the recent Australian situation. So over the past 3 years, there have been quite sizable changes in the size and composition of Australia's current account and capital account. So what I've got here is the purple line is the current account deficit in Australia. The light blue lines are private capital flows, so flows from into the Australian private side of the financial of the Australian economy. So that's the light blue ones. The orange lines are offshore investment in Australian public sector assets, so by and large Australian government debt. The light green lines are investment by the Australian private sector abroad And the purple bits are the stuff that we do at the Reserve Bank, mostly around changes in reserve holdings. So you can see, so one first point to make is that the purple line for the current account deficit masks large capital flows in both directions. So there is not, you know, there is not just one way inflow which is, you know, of equal and the same size to the current account deficit, which moves one for one from it. There are actually large capital flows going in both directions and changing in by quite a large amount through time. So from the early 1990s until 2007, Australia recorded a current account deficit which averaged around 4.25% of GDP, which in the current context would generally be considered to be an imbalance or excessive. There were cycles around that level, with the current account narrowing to 2% of GDP in 2001 in the aftermath of the Asian crisis, widening to around 6% in 2007. At the same time, up until 2007 at least, there was reasonable stability in the major components of the capital account. The inflow arising from the offshore funding of the banking sector was around 3.5% of GDP. So this led to the common assessment that the Australian banking sector was funding the Australian current account deficit. So in my opinion, that conclusion is incomplete. As mentioned earlier, a current account deficit and its equivalent capital account surplus is the net outcome of considerably larger gross flows, and that's what this picture shows. Throughout this period, there was substantial Australian investment abroad, which is the light green bar. Much of this was the result of the Australian superannuation sector, or Australian pension sector, investing a sizable share of their funds in offshore equity markets. At times, there are also sizable equity inflows to Australia. So while we could say, you know, you could assert that the Australian banking sector funds the current account deficit with equal validity, you could actually say that if the Australian super sector hadn't invested abroad, there wouldn't have been the same sort of outcome either. So over the past few years, the composition of these capital flows, this is the last three bars at the end here, particularly the last bar, the composition of these capital flows has changed quite significantly, providing some contrary evidence to the hypothesis that the banks fund the current account. I don't think there are any, in doing so, I'm not saying there was any particular problem with the structure of the capital flows beforehand, and I don't think there's any particular problem with the structure of the capital flows now. They're just changed and they're different, that's all. So in 2010, the net inflow to the Australian banking sector was actually close to zero. So what I've done here is I've just focused, despite wanting to talk about gross flows, we're going to talk about net flows just for a minute. So I've got here the net inflow to the Australian banking sector. So this is the offshore financial sector basically buying Australian bank paper, by and large. And the purple bit is short-term bank paper, and the yellow bit is long-term bank paper, and then the line is the net of all of those. So in 2010, right at the end there, so this observation here, that's actually the net inflow to the Australian banking sector was actually slightly negative. Indeed, over the last three quarters of 2010, the Australian banking sector was a net repayer of its offshore liabilities. That is, maturities exceeded issuance. This did not reflect a lack of appetite for Australian bank paper, as the cost of issuance was broadly flat or even slightly lower over that period. Indeed, as I discussed in a speech last week, it reflected the fact that the banks had less need for wholesale borrowing, given the conjuncture of fast deposit growth domestically and subdued asset growth. The terming out of the banking sector's funding is also evident. So you can see that most of the net repayment has actually been in repayment of short-term liabilities, whereas they've actually still been net issuing long-term liabilities. So this picture is reinforced if we include flows into the Australian non-bank securitised assets, so particularly for the benefit of our international guests. So mortgage-backed securities were a reasonable share of the Australian housing market, about 20% up prior to 2007 in terms of the stock of housing credit out there. So not as large as they are in the US, but still a non-trivial share of the financing of the Australian home lending. It was all, by the way, it was a completely private set up. There was no government support of that market. So what I've got here with the purple bars is net foreign investment in Australian securities. So you can see up until 2007, a lot of the mortgage-backed securities were sold to offshore investors, and in fact, particularly structured investment vehicles who don't exist anymore. And then as those securities either matured or were sold back onshore, then over the last couple of quarters, then those numbers have shifted to being negative. So those net inflows amounted to around 1% to 2% in GDP through the first half of the 2000s, and as that graph shows, there have been net outflows over the past 3 years. That change in net flows reflected the sharp drop-off in global appetite for securitised product as the problems in the US housing market came to the fore. Didn't reflect any particular problem with the Australian mortgage-backed securities market. So here's an example where there's been a marked shift in the change in capital flows. There's no underlying distortion here except for a marked change in investor behaviour. I mean, the distortion to the extent it existed was in the US mortgage-backed securities market, and ours was tainted with association. Although recent developments suggest that appetite for those assets is growing again, at least both on and offshore. So in 2010, while the bank sector's net offshore borrowing was zero, the current account deficit in Australia, while narrower than earlier years, was still 2.5% of GDP. So what's happened is that there's been a significant change in the composition of those capital flows. So if I back up, the flow which has changed most materially is this orange flow, which is offshore purchases of Australian government debt, which have become a popular investment over the last couple of years or so. So we've had a shift in the composition of the capital flows from the private sector towards buying Australian government paper. And the net of that's more than offset some of that decline in capital flows into the banking sector. So that's looking at things from the capital account side of things. If I now swing to looking at things from the current account side of the balance of payments, the most notable development has been the shift in the trade balance from deficit to surplus, as the much commented on rise in Australia's terms of trade has significantly boosted resource export earnings. So again, for those of you who don't live in this country, terms of trade are basically at 100 and something year highs at the moment, as the supposedly secular decline in commodity prices has been rapidly and significantly reversed. So in that respect, it's sometimes remarked upon that absent the terms of trade rise, so if we didn't have this terms of trade rise, our current account deficit would be significantly wider. Although that ignores the fact that the exchange rate has also appreciated significantly alongside the terms of trade, thereby reducing the boost to export earnings as well as causing changes in domestic absorption and production. Another effect of the rise in the terms of trade has been on the net income deficit. So because a sizable share of Australia's resource sector is foreign-owned, the increased income of that sector partly leaks into a higher payment to the foreign owners, either in the form of dividend payments or retained earnings. So the net income deficit part of the current... So we've got a trade surplus, which is a couple of percent of GDP, but we've got a net income deficit, which is more around 3.5% of GDP. A fair chunk of that is payments to the owners of the Australian... the offshore owners of the Australian mining sector. So that flow obviously would also not be recurring if the terms of trade were not at their current level. So what I want to... the point I'm trying to make here today, or the conclusion I want to draw, and let me... start my conclusion with a quote from Hamlet, which is that there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. So current account deficits are neither good or bad until you start thinking about them. That's the point I want to make there. So current account deficits do have a bad reputation, which I don't think is always warranted. So while some current account positions are the result of distortionary policies that should be redressed, others are not. And so the examples I discussed earlier around the household sector and the Australian states show that there are configurations of current account positions and capital flows that should not be a cause for concern. Indeed, in many cases, they are beneficial and facilitate a productive reallocation of global capital. So at a minimum, I would ask for at least a more nuanced examination of current account positions and the associated capital flows rather than a simple focus on headline numbers. So let me finish there.
I fully agree with the main thesis, but focusing on Australia is not doing justice to some of the concern of the discussion, which is focusing frequently on developing countries.
Yeah.
So the contrast between Australia and, say, Argentina is the key.
Yeah.
Because my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, Australia never defaulted on any sovereign debt.
No.
Argentina defaulted with frequency of every 25, 30 years.
Yeah.
So had I been an Argentinian citizen, I'd say, gee, if you'd like to destroy the middle class, don't care about current account deficits of Argentina, but then you pay a social cost. So going back to Europe, you're only totally right that Europe has a bias towards a zero current account, but Germany in the past used to have a current account surplus and a periphery current account deficit.
Mm.
And without inciting Greece and Portugal, they are really developing countries that by chance are hooked to the Germany via a fixed exchange rate. So I fully agree that if you don't have distortions, then all that you said is correct, and Australia is the best textbook that I can think, assuming that I'm correct and you never defaulted on sovereign debt. I'm less assured about developing countries. Now, if you're looking more carefully, all the countries that are developing countries that are growing nicely, typically they are not relying on current account deficits. They are self-funded.
Hmm.
So I agree with your thesis, but I think that some of the concern and discussion focus on developing countries and not on other Australians of the universe that are rarity among developing countries.
Sure. No, I completely take your point. I suppose what I'm doing by I'm just holding up in Australia as an example. It seems to me at the moment there's almost an assumption that all deficits and surpluses are, deficits in particular, are bad. And I'm just trying to at least provide one example where that's not the case, and at least the framework for thinking about how one might go about thinking about it. It is true that we haven't ever defaulted on sovereign debt. There was one state government which got close in the 1930s but didn't quite get there. But no Australian sovereign has defaulted. But as I said, I just think the analysis is somewhat simplistic in, as I said, focusing on the headline number without looking at the underlying, particularly at the underlying flows, which brings us back to the discussion we're having this morning about focusing more on the capital flows side of things rather than on the current account side of things is at least as useful.
Thank you. I was interested to hear that you finished with a quote from Hamlet, because the author I was thinking of before you got to that was Voltaire, who had a character who said repeatedly that everything was the best in all possible worlds, in the best of all possible worlds. And while I completely accept your headline argument that, of course, just as basic premise of financial intermediation holds, some people, it's logical, some people would be savers and others dissavers at various times in their life cycle, so we should expect that to be potentially the case in terms of international flows of capital. My sticking point, where I think perhaps there's a slightly rosy view, is you said, well, bad, how do you know when they're good or bad? And you said, well, it depends on whether there's some distortions that we can point to. Now, I really wonder whether this is a very good guide, because given that we, as you say, often don't know ex ante whether there are distortions, not many people were speaking loudly about them in the case of the US prior to the crisis, it seems that it's almost inevitable that the definition of a distortion is going to be very ideologically driven and also probably affected by the special interests of those who gain from those distortions or non-distortions, and I would worry about that.
Yeah, I certainly didn't want to come across as some sort of Panglossian by any means, but it's not so much that I would move away from the distortions, it's come back again to the capital flows, and again it's relevant to the discussion we're having this morning. Look at those capital flows, decide whether they're problematic in and of themselves rather than look at sort of what does it imply about some net balance of some particular number. Look at those capital flows and then I think you move a little bit, sometimes you will be able to say, yes, there's clearly a distortion which is generating those flows and we can do something about that. Or you can say, well, no, regardless of whether I can identify that distortion or not, these capital flows are concerning and maybe I want to think about doing something about that. So it's partly as much an argument, I think, about focusing more on the capital flows side of things rather than on the current account side of things, which is where a lot of the time the global debate ends up.
Looks like I've jumped the queue here. The pitch of view is very attractive in some ways, but it does rely on the market working well, and we now know a lot more about that after 2008. The lesson that we all should have learned is that the market that we all considered to be the best in the whole world, the New York money market, actually dried up for a while. Now, as it happened, Australia was able to sail through that very easily. because of the AAA rating of the country and the AA rating of the banks. Our reaction to that is to look at the banks and see that flow that came into the banks as being a vulnerability of the Australian system, and in a sense encourage the banks through various prudential measures to do more of their funding at home. But if the current account doesn't change, it's lower than home but could go back to its average level, someone's got to fund that. And if it's not the banks in future, then it will be people with not only a lower credit rating in the eyes of the world, but not able to be helped in the way the banks were helped in 2008 by a guarantee. It's all very well for the government to guarantee the trip to the AA banks, but it would be another thing to guarantee capital inflows that came in via lower rated commercial companies. Should we be concerned about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something we certainly should think about. Again, it comes back to the point, I suppose, which I'm trying to get across, is that you want to look at those that composition of those capital flows and work out whether that's what you're comfortable with. I mean, if you look at what's going on in Brazil at the moment, with the large capital flows that they've experienced over the past year or two, and you know, and they've, again, relating to the discussion we had this morning, they've taken some of that in the form of an exchange rate appreciation, some of that in the form of reserves accumulation, and some of it in the form of capital controls. They've actually been fairly, they've picked and they've been fairly selective in how they've imposed those capital controls and picked on particular aspects of the capital flow and tried to, with varying degrees of success, have tried to impose restrictions on particular components of the capital account. So, again, it relates to the question. The point I'm trying to get across is that I think you need to look at the composition of those flows and think about how you're whether you're comfortable with the composition of those flows. And I think exactly the same applies. That way of looking at things, I think, applies to both developed and to emerging economies.
Thanks, Danny. I wouldn't really agree with Josh's point about not having a current account deficit for development. For me, one of the longest-running current account deficits was Canada, 20 years before 1940. A huge current account deficit. The country developed, the lenders got repaid, everyone was happy, it was a great thing. See, then the crucial point is not so much the size of the deficit, but the return journey you're talking
about. Yes, yeah,
and
exactly.
You can get a bit of a Natasha's problem for distortions by saying it's okay as long as the debts get repaid. And the problem is, why do people lend when they're not going to get repaid? And it's about information. And the example you gave was the complex chain from US mortgages. But that wasn't really an international problem so much. I mean, it was as true for domestic lenders as for foreign lenders. It was really more a belief that you would get repaid. And it seems a bit with the Greek and Irish crisis the same, that it's more an issue to do with moral hazard and public policy, that people believe that they will get repaid, maybe moral hazard to long term. They believe they will get repaid in a certain sense, you shouldn't have lent to Greece, but everyone thought it was rock solid, they'll get bailed out. So in that sense, and this is a question really, and to what extent is it a public policy issue, giving the false impressions that bad loans will be bailed out, rather than public policy issue of trying to deal on a micro level with distortions?
Yeah, I mean, Max actually goes into the US situation in quite a bit of detail in his paper. And I think, I mean, what I'd say there is, that was as much a function of the environment at the time, where just risk was completely mispriced across a whole bunch of things. That was the most obvious, at least with hindsight, the most obvious manifestation of it. So there wasn't, I don't think there was an assumption there that you're always going to get bailed out on the US housing market, and indeed you haven't. I just don't think there was an assumption that there wasn't even a questioning of the return journey, and that was what I meant about the failure of due diligence, was there was just not even any questioning about whether you were going to get repaid. It wasn't information, partly because no one actually asked for the information, I think, was part of the issue. I think it was a failure of due diligence. I mean, if people had asked, they may have found out that they had less information than they actually had, than they thought they did. But no one actually really, very few people It's not true that no one did. There were obviously a number of people who did ask that question and did quite nicely out of it, but not enough people actually even asked the question, and and then to even test whether the information was there or whether it was valid.
Enjoyed the talk. Two quick questions. One is, I was looking at your chart, first one, I guess, 207, the purple things, the net RBA transactions, about 3% of GDP, that was selling of in foreign exchange intervention to defend the currency somewhat. Is that how you read it? How
mostly, mostly intervention was actually in 2008, so... So that one doesn't quite work. Although that, actually that must be the case actually, because I can't think there's no other transaction which is going to deliver that.
So the reason I asked then is so if you're just if you look at the charts and you're talking about a current account deficit, give or take, 5-6% of GDP, gross inflows of 14%, outflows of 11%, and so as an equivalent amount of foreign exchange intervention. To make up the difference. If you took such a benign view on current accounts and the market, etc., why not just allow things to adjust in that situation? Second point, in terms of and relating to the exchange rate, very interesting about the, clearly one of the intriguing aspects is the extent of appreciation of the Aussie dollar in nominal and real terms. Has that had an impact on the, it's not had an impact directly on the Australian economy as a whole, but in terms of, say, export-oriented manufacturing, have you had a touch-to-cease type problem?
So let me answer the first question. And it comes back to something I said. So the exchange rate can overshoot, obviously, which I think the implication of that is the optimal reserves holding are not zero. So you hold some reserves because there will be circumstances where overshooting occurs, and so that gives you a positive number. And so we deployed those reserves in that situation when that was occurring. On the Dutch disease question, there is a lot of discussion on that topic, and it's almost daily in the paper in one form or another these days. So, I mean, that boils down to, I think, one fundamental question, which is how long-lived do you think this event is going to be? So Dutch disease is a situation where there's a large rise in your terms of trade, which is fairly short-lived. So you get the real exchange rate appreciation causes sectoral reallocation. The whole thing unwinds in a couple of years' time, and then you've destroyed your export competing sector. If you're looking at something which is going to be around for a few decades or so, and I'm not, this is what the question boils down to. So, if you think this thing is going to be fairly long-lived, that's not Dutch disease. That's sectoral. That's structural change. So there'll be a change. There needs to be a change in the structure of the economy. To take account of this permanent change in relative prices. So the Dutch disease question really boils down to how permanent do you think this relative price change is going to be? If you think it's temporary, then you're going to have one set of policy responses. If you think it's permanent, there's a different set of policy responses.
Josh? I think that the US, for me, is an example about your point, that distortions matter a lot. And among the most distorted sectors in the US is the housing market. And the distortions are coming first by the tax code that, unlike in Germany, is subsidizing ownership. And the second is that all the Freddie Mays and comparable institutions subsidize the provision of mortgages, providing, if you wish, the bailout option that is exercised now. And my point is that definitely the housing crisis is not due to the current deficit of the US. On the other hand, in the US, as Dimar pointed out, that the business cycle in the US is the housing cycle. Mm. And I think that one can argue that considering these distortions, the running the current account deficit that at the peak reached 6% of the US GDP prolonged the appreciation of the real estate, i.e. in financial autarky, it would have been, the crisis would have happened, but it wouldn't have been such a deep crisis. So I totally agree with your point that the real problems are the internal distortion of the U.S., but the ability of the U.S. to entertain current account deficit because 6% intensified the crisis. Yes. So beyond this, I agree that it's up to the U.S. to shape its housing order, and so far, I'm not sure if we have seen it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Just a thought, which is a reaction to a number of people kind of saying, well, the Tanjan is very important, and tending to associate these things still with the fortress. I like your picture of the flows between the different Australian provinces. If you think of the different Australian townships, of course you're not going to be able to measure this. Mm. But there's nothing unreasonable about forever having the distribution of property in existence being very different from the distribution of the ownership of property.
Yeah.
So you would expect deficits between the townships to reach that deficit to some extent.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think it's a question of where does the border start to matter? I think is another way of putting it. I think, which is I think is an interesting way to think about the question.